As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Stole it in the side, baby, diamond ring.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
Hey, this is the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for another Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. I'll be speaking today with Mark Ribbler, who is Little Steven's Disciples of Soul music director, and Mark is also a solo artist. His latest single is called Shattered. It's available from Wicked Cool Records and is a recent coolest song in the world. Let's hear some of it now, and then I'll be back to chat with Mark on your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Here as we get your coolest conversations underway. And our guest today is Mark Ribbler. In addition to being the music director for Little Steven's Disciples of Soul, his debut solo single for Wicked Cool Records, Shattered, is available now, and it's this week's coolest song in the world. How are you, Mark?
I'm doing great, Manfred. It's good to hear you, man.
Good to be with you. Now, we passed another somber number of COVID deaths here in the U.S., 500,000. Yeah. Have you and your family and friends managed to stay healthy over the course of the pandemic?
Yeah, Manfred. Thankfully, my dad, who's 88, and we watch after him. I haven't hugged or kissed my dad in a year, but we see him. Me and my sister go over to his house. We sit literally 20 feet apart in the living room with masks, and we bring him food and. It's been a rough year, but, you know, he's a trooper, and thank God he's healthy. I'm healthy. My girlfriend's healthy. That's all you can ask for, man. It's been, obviously, for all of us, probably one of the most challenging years of our lives. And, you know, I have some friends that have been affected, as we all have. And I know of some deaths with close friends. But it's, you take it a day at a time and just try to be safe.
Absolutely. Let me ask you one more question about your dad. So you mentioned he's 88, and you and your... Did you say your sister go over and visit him?
Yes.
So does he live by himself?
He lives by himself. My mom, who was very ill the last couple years of our tours, she passed in the middle of our Summer of Sorcery tour, and we were in Europe. Yes, yeah, so it was rough not being home. But that being said, you know, having Steven as a boss, you know, he told me to go home, you know, just go home and be with your family, you know, when she passed. And, actually, 3 weeks before she passed, we were touring the Northeast.
Yeah.
And Steven said, I think just like intuitively, because I don't like to, when we're on the road, I don't like to burden. And essentially, he decided that we would hub from home for 3 weeks. And that meant, you know, we'd fly to some places like in the Northeast, but, you know, we'd drive anywhere possible.
Right.
And that allowed me to spend 3 weeks with my mom every single day in the month of July and create this healing. Yeah. And if it wasn't for that, I truly feel I'd be in a different place in my life right now and it wouldn't be better. Yeah. So that was certainly a blessing. And literally I spent the 3 weeks with her. I spent my birthday with her. We flew to Europe. we were in Warsaw. My sister was keeping me posted, and she told me to get home. This is like early August. I'd already had Ira Siegel, dear friend and great guitar player. I had him all prepared because I knew, you know, my mom could go at any time. So Ira came and he did a great job. He subbed for me for a week, mm-hmm. and it was pretty seamless. I came back, and coming back was the medicine I needed to, you know, to process, or just to kind of, you know, in a peaceful place for a while, you know. And then we came home, and, you know, I was able to look after my dad. And then of course the pandemic hit, you know. Yeah. That's kind of like the long short story of that.
So we spoke once before. It was almost exactly 4 years ago, this month, I know, on our Coolest Conversations. And this was just a couple of months before the release of Little Steven's Soulfire album. And as I recall, you were originally from Brooklyn, but you grew up in New Jersey.
That's right, Manfred. Yes, I grew up in the projects in Brooklyn, New York. My friends were Black and Jewish and Hispanic, you know, cultural melting pot. Then we moved to Jackson, New Jersey, and essentially it was all white people. And, you know, I never really experienced any kind of racial tension, or so that was like a new thing. So it really kind of filtered into me as a musician and a songwriter. Like, why do people behave like this? You know, what's at the core of this, you know?
So then, I want to add to this, your story there, because I didn't recall that. And that's very similar to my own upbringing. The first high school I went to was predominantly Black, and this was in the South. It was a 5-year high school, 8th through 12th. And so when I was entering 11th grade, my family moved from one end of the county to the other end. And it was a culture shock. You understand this, but to other people hearing this, that may not make any sense. But it really was like I'd always heard that there were more, that whites were in the plurality or majority white, but I'd never actually lived in a situation where that was the case. Where I'd lived, it was always, you know, at least as many Black folks.
Yeah, you grew up in integrated environments.
Right. And then when I went to the other end of the county and we moved there, it was like I had never seen that many white people in my life, that it was really shocking. But everybody was, well, in fact, the high school was twice the size where I had been. And at that high school, that's where I became aware of a lot of, you know, there's a lot of racial things that I didn't, if it was present where I was before, it never really manifested itself. You know, here there were just people that were just blatantly racist. And yes. As you said, it was like a culture shock.
Yeah, it's a culture shock. And I mean, fortunately, you know, my parents were always very, they were liberal, and they told me to treat everyone as equal. You know, if, you know, you treat people with respect, and to my, you know, my best friends were Black. And then, you know, there's maybe two Black people in the entire elementary school. And I could feel this energy that was cast upon them, you know, and it was being at that tender age, you know, just to feel like an outcast, or made to feel like an outcast. It's, yeah. It just always felt wrong, and always made me sort of hypersensitive to, you know, the plight of people that are, you know, on sort of like the periphery of, you know, the bigger part of the population. Now it's just like, it seems like it's so deeply ingrained for generations in people that it's just a way of being. And that, you know, I think it's human to look at things and put things in filing cabinets or categorize, or, but when you're taught, you know, if something is, well, this is good and this isn't good, and that's it eventually it's in your DNA. And we have a lot of healing to do, because if we can't get along, then how long can we survive if we can't even, you know, coexist? So
you mentioned feeling this kind of outcast sensation with, after you made this move. Does that play into your musical background at all? I mean, was becoming involved with music sort of an outlet to kind of find yourself, or?
Absolutely. It was the saving, the guitar. When I was 11 years old, I started playing guitar, and that, you don't know it because you don't know, you know, you think you're choosing things, but it's sort of, it kind of chose me. And I realized very young, maybe within a few months, that it was like a holy grail. It was the thing that I could turn to that understood. It was like this unconditional understanding, and a place that I could, vent my discontent or my unhappiness in the world. Mm-hmm. And it would give back a feeling of, it would give back a feeling of empowerment. And I didn't even know what that was at that age, but I would, throughout my life, I've always, it's always been a safe haven. It's always been a place where I can go and find, you know, sanctuary and solitude and heal. And then, you know, at when I was like 14, first I was playing with local like rock and roll musicians like my own age. And then I excelled pretty quickly because I was very determined to be, I wanted to be a great guitar player like from the onset. So within a couple of years, I could play like 13, 14 years old. I could, you know, I was really into Jimi Hendrix and you know, Johnny Winter and the Allman Brothers. And I would sit in my room for hours and absorb and learn these records. And I learned, I don't know, from a friend or someone told me that if you put the record at half speed, it slows the lick down. It's in the same key, but half the speed. And I could actually, it sort of explained what they were doing much better. You know, you could understand it at that speed. Anyway, I started at 15, I joined a black R&B band. Me and the drummer were the only white musicians. And that was a whole, you know, to go from rock and roll, you know, and I grew up listening to WABC radio in New York. That was the Renaissance period of all music, of, you know, of rock and roll and R&B and soul and country and folk. You'd put that radio station on and you would hear the Jackson Five. Then you would hear the Rolling Stones. Then you would hear, you know, Norman Greenbaum's Spirit in the Sky and another melting pot, you know. I listened to this music, but it gave me a deeper understanding of funk and just like a different sense of rhythm than we were playing straight ahead rock tunes like the Stones and, you know, Jimi Hendrix. Certainly there was a lot of that in his music. So
how old were you when you were playing with these guys?
I started playing with the R&B band when I was 15.
Okay. Wow. And your parents, they were pretty cool with you pursuing music as a career?
Man, you know, I could not have asked for a better support system. Although my mom had different, I think she had a different idea of what I would end up doing with my life as a career. I think she would prefer it if I went to college and became a professional. But you know, we both had very strong wills and strong spirits. And I there was nothing for me in high school. I ended up dropping out of high school. My sophomore year, I went maybe 100 of, you know, of 300 days or however many school days you go to. And then the first day of my junior year, my dad signed me out and he understood, you know, that I was determined to play music. And, you know, it took a little while, but my mom got it. But they were always supportive. They would let us rehearse in the basement, or I think that really helped, you know, like not having any resistance about, you know, this is my life. And, you know, just the fact that they embraced it, it was a beautiful thing.
I know you came to, I think anyway, that you came to Steven's attention by being Darlene Love's music director. How did you wind up working with her?
Funny enough, with Steven, actually, you know, I played on the last song on Introducing Darlene Love. My friend Rich Mercurio, who was the guy I called, you know, first as Steven's drummer, because I knew how much Steven loved working with him in the studio. Mm-hmm. And my friend Lee Nadel, Lee was playing bass, and they were trying like the last, they started playing on the record maybe halfway through, and they were trying to get me on a date, on a session. And it was the very last song. And I got the call, you know, the night before from Jeff Sanoff, who's Steven's engineer, and went down the next day. And, you know, I met Steven that day. And the interesting thing is there was a lot of common ground, because growing up playing at the Jersey Shore, a guy that I'd done a lot of gigs with was this guy, Kevin Cavanaugh. Kevin was the original keyboardist for the Jukes. And Steven, you know, he was a partner in crime of Steven's for many years. You know, they did all those, the Stone Pony residency, you know, together. And he played on all the early Jukes records. I think he may have played on at least the first Disciples of Soul record. So I was doing a lot of gigs with Kevin, and Kevin had just passed away. And we, you know, so me and Steven just started talking, and we were sort of reminiscing about Kevin a little bit. And then what I was hired to basically play guitar, you know, do a guitar track. It ended up into a 10-hour session, and Steven had me, you know, he created this wall of sound on this Bruce cover that Darlene sang on Night Closing In is the name of the song. Stephen basically, you know, was channeling the way Phil Spector would make a record. It was, you know, there was this bolero 12-string guitar part, and, you know, he had me do that four times, and he had me do the 12-string electric part four times. And, you know, we bonded on, you know, that aside from I could play what he asked pretty much, you know, pretty quickly, just creating this wall of sound, you know. And so by the end of the day, you know, I just felt like I made a new friend, and we had just met. This is like 2014, probably the winter of 2014. A few months later, after Darlene's record was ready to come out, Stephen called to help with her CD releases, which was, we did one at the Paramount in Asbury Park, and we did a couple shows at the Whiskey in LA. And he wasn't really completely satisfied with her band at the time, and asked me to put together a strong band to really, you know, so that his arrangements could be heard, you know, in the correct light. And so that Darlene, you know, had a great chance at, you know, making a even bigger impression and mark on the industry.
Right.
So I ended up doing that. He asked me to be her musical director. I did that for about a year and a half, and actually almost 2 years. And then he called me to, like, a year later, I guess a year and a half later, to put a band together for this one-off that we were going to do at the London Blues Festival. Mm-hmm. This guy, Leo Green, called him. He was already invited to Bill Wyman's 80th birthday and was going to play at that. And Leo asked him to do a full set. So I got my guys, you know, I got Rich Mercurio and Jack Daly and Andy Burton, and me and Eddie put the horn section together. And, you know, 3 years later, you know, we're finishing up the Summer Sorcery Tour and only stopped for a minute here and there in between, you know. So it sort of really happened very quickly. And it was sort of, you know, it was like a date with destiny, meeting Stephen. So
I saw that you mentioned playing with Darlene a couple of dates out in Los Angeles at the Whiskey A Go-Go. And I did see the show out there, and it really was fantastic. It was really great, I have to say.
That's right, man. We played a Friday night and a Saturday night. That's right.
Yeah, yeah. And so I saw one of those two, and I thought it was really phenomenal.
22-piece band on the Whiskey stage.
I know. I don't know how everybody squeezed on there, because I've been up there before, and it was really cool. And, you know, what was great too about Darlene, you know, she's this national treasure, and her voice is just so killer. And then also, that is the first time that I had seen Stephen as a performer and live, right?
Yeah.
I never, you know, years ago, I hadn't seen the Disciples of Soul whenever they were playing out. It's, you know, as you know, it's like one thing to see a clip of somebody playing, but to see the sweat firsthand is always way more dynamic. And it was just,
yeah,
it was,
man, I was, because I, you know, I've certainly known of Stephen and, you know, been a fan of, you know, just growing up down here, you know, knowing the legends. And playing, you know, I love playing with Darlene, but one of the highlights of those shows was doing three songs with Stephen. You know, we did Love on the Wrong Side of Town, yeah, Forever, and Until the Good Is Gone. And several times I said to Stephen afterwards, I said, man, you need to be doing this, because this is fucking good, man. It just felt right, you know, so I'm glad that he chose to do that.
And so the roles of music director with a couple of years with Darlene, and then now the Disciples of Soul, how are those similar? How are those different?
Darlene, I basically would protect, you know, I was really protecting Stephen's arrangements, making sure that they were, you know, executed as great as possible with, you know, with great musicians.
Yeah.
Darlene, you know, the thing with Darlene was more of, it was just making sure that she was happy with the keys that songs were in, you know, certainly the personnel had to be great players, no drama, you know, just like I would have. And certainly Stephen. And with Stephen basically in his band, in the Disciples of Soul, he's such an active role in the music, you know, in the arranging. Although with Darlene, he actually arranged her entire Christmas tour. So he rearranged all the Phil Spector songs. And before we went out on tour, you know, because her big season is her Christmas shows, you know. Right. So with Steven, it was more like, you know, making sure the band had their shit together, had the music, had the dates, you know, just kind of keeping people on top. You know, we get to sound check. Everyone had to know their parts, the song of, you know, whatever song that we were going to learn for, you know, the first tour or two. We were doing at every sound check, we would learn one or two songs for that night's performance. And that's after, you know, travel, you know, you fly in, go to the hotel, go right to sound check. So the first few tours, it was pretty rigorous, you know, and it's great, man. It really keeps you at the top of your game. You know, you can't slack off. Otherwise, you're going to fall by the wayside, you know?
Right. Hey, let's talk some about your new single, Shattered. Yeah. It's this week's coolest song in the world. It's your debut release for Wicked Cool Records, the full album, The Whole World Awaits You, that's supposed to come out later. See, you've done solo albums in the past. How did this project get off the ground?
Very interesting. You know, we made the Soulfire record in 2016, and we basically recorded it. It was pretty much mixed, you know, soup to nuts in 6 weeks. You know, Clear Mountain mixed it.
Yeah.
And then Steven, you know, they did that show with the E Street Band, did the show on Saturday Night Live. And then Steven had 2 months more committed with Bruce before he was kind of freed up to do his thing. And in those 2 months, I'd been thinking about doing a record for a few years. And that being said, when, you know, if I'm Darlene's musical director or Steven's, you know, it's so consuming, you know, psychically and physically that you really can't focus on your own record, you know. Mm-hmm. But I had 2 months off from Steven. So I got my guys, you know, Richie, Jack, and Andy, and we went in for 2 or 3 days to the studio in Long Branch Shorefire and recorded basic tracks for 15 songs. I did preliminary mixes, and, you know, by early April, I had pretty rough arrangements and rough mixes, preliminary mixes, and then went out with Steven and just kind of put it aside. I really didn't have time to think about it literally until 3 some odd years later. And, you know, here we are a month into the pandemic in the beginning of April. And me and Steven were on the phone. You know, we hadn't spoken in a few weeks, and he asked me what I was doing. And I said, I'm mixing my record. He goes, your record? He goes, I didn't know you were making a record. He goes, let me hear that. You know? So I sent him a bunch of songs, and I probably sent him 12 or, you know, maybe even more songs. He called me up and he says, I got some good news and I got some bad news.
good news. Which did you ask to hear first?
You know, I probably wanted to hear the bad news first.
Yeah.
But I think somehow I remember getting the good news first.
Okay.
The good news is I love a lot of these songs. The bad news is, and, you know, ultimately it's not bad news, but, you know, and actually it was fucking great news. He says, I'd like to rework some of these arrangements with you and get involved in the production. I mean, initially Steven said, I'd like to be the executive producer, and I'd like to release the record on Wicked Cool, which I was ecstatic about. You know, I mean, I've been in the business for many years, and I've, you know, I had a development deal with RCA Records that they dropped all their development things when grunge came out, and, you know, I've had songs on the charts and this, that, and the other thing. So I've been, you know, I've been working at getting a record deal for, you know, for 30 some odd years, you know, so, and just knowing how passionate Steven is, you know, and I was ecstatic. So we basically spent the next couple months virtually because of the pandemic. We weren't never in the same room together, and I would work on ideas that we came up with and send him, you know, like rough mixes of it. And we'd go back and forth. And within a couple months, by the middle of the summer, I felt like we had this really strong record. And working with Steven, who, you know, he understands all the nuts and bolts of making great records and, you know, certainly making hit records. You know, he's had great successes. So it was, you know, after working with him so much on his music and Darlene's music and other projects along the way, it was a very enlightening and enriching experience. So, it was the medicine that I needed to get through the pandemic.
Oh, I hear you about that. Specifically about Shattered. Now, you wrote that with Christina Aldendiefer.
That's right. That's right.
Who is she?
She's a Nashville writer. She's had a couple cuts. She's had a couple cuts with Leanne Rimes, and so she was recommended by this guy, Steve Bogart. He's like very involved in the industry down in Nashville, and he thought that, you know, it would be good for us. I used to go down every month or so back in like the late, you know, 2009, 2010. And I would do, you know, like these writing hits, you know, to get cuts and, you know, just to kind of put some irons and some different fires.
Yeah.
You know, I'd written with, you know, there's obviously a lot of great songwriters down there, and we just really connected. You know, I've been a lyricist my whole life, but it's always great when you find another lyricist that there's common ground and, you know, you like their sense of imagery and, you know, the use of imagery. And so we just connected, and that we wrote that song the first time we got together in her kitchen. We finished it when I got back to New Jersey, and I made like a demo of it at the time. And as I was making the demo, I was feeling like, man, I like this song. You know, we'll pitch it for a cover, but this is something I might want to use. And this is like 2010, we wrote it. So it's something that was always in the back of my mind. And when I went in with those guys in 2017 to record, I included it as one of the songs, and I'm really happy that I did, you know. And when I played it for Steven, we spent a little time like on the vocal arrangement, and, you know, Steven's really good at cutting out fat, you know, like the intro was twice as long, and we just got rid of extraneous things in the song that, you know, that everything worked, but it made it more concise.
Yeah.
It made it quite, kind of more, you know, a little more streamlined and I think more effective. When Dennis was the first one that said maybe that should be the first single, and I was like, I was down for it, because I always find that that's a good song to kind of, you know, if you're driving somewhere, you know, it's a good driving song, you know. And
here, when you mentioned Dennis, we're talking about Dennis Mortensen, who runs Wicked Cool Records for Steven.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you about the inspiration for the song. So Christina, you mentioned her being a lyricist, and I agree, the sort of the visual palette there is really cool. Does this inspiration for the song come from a specific heart-wrenching event, do you know? Or is it, you know, sort of a composite of them?
You know, yes, I would say, you know, throughout our lives, you know, and many of us can relate, you know, you meet the unattainable person that won't go away and twists and turns you into a crazy straw, you know? And so it's about that person that you'd like it to work, and delusionally you think maybe you can make it work, but it's never going to work. And, you know, the person that keeps breaking your heart, you know, or shattering your heart.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, probably Christina went through some of that as well. And, so the lyric came very fast to us. Like we wrote 90% of the lyric that day, and then just refined it, you know, when I was making the demo. Yeah.
So you mentioned having some kind of deal with RCA years ago, and I know you've written songs for other artists, Canadian rockers, German rockers. You've also done tunes for ads. And one thing that caught my eye was writing music, I guess, for a Trojan condom ad. And I was wondering, was that any more fun to do as opposed to one for Office Depot or V8?
Well, yes, and certainly more artistically rewarding, believe it or not. You know, I mean, it wasn't Trojan Man. You know, it was an HIV and STD awareness commercial.
Oh, okay.
They just sent me picture, you know, like, the, you know, of this couple holding hands on the couch, and then the screen goes black and it says 40% of people with HIV don't tell their partners. And I was like, fuck me. It just hit me like right in the chest, man. And I had this song kicking around for a while. I'm a songwriter, so writing ads, you know, and I understand hooks, you know, growing up with WABC, and hooks are a very important thing. But anyway, it seems like more commercials at that time in the mid 2000s and now are kind of song driven. So I had this song, and the lyric in the chorus was, "This is our love, this is our life. It's the perfect chance to get it right." And I made this quick, you know, like 1 minute demo of the song, and the agency felt it was it. And of course, you know, these guys are so scared of losing their jobs. We literally spent the next 6 weeks trying to reinvent. They were trying to reinvent the song into something else. And ultimately, it came 160 degrees pretty much back to where it was. You know, it's like,
oh, cool.
And you don't want to make a wrong decision, you know? So it's the craziest business. I mean, I never in a million years imagined making TV ads, but the Trojan commercial was, it was a rewarding experience, you know, and it's nice getting mailbox money. It's nice not having to worry about, you know, the next gig for a while, you know, and it's a very interesting thing, man. Yeah. We did an Activia commercial. We actually had that ran for like 10 years. It's a whole different thing, but, and I actually made that, I put that song, it was part of my record at that time as well. So.
Oh, and what, just remind us, what is that record called that has it on it?
That album's called This Life. It's actually the title track from that record.
This Life. Yeah. So you performed recently as part of the Light of Day benefit. Can you remind everybody what that event is for?
Yeah, it's for Parkinson's research. And it's something I've been doing for probably the past 9 years or so. My friend Tony Palgrossi, he's on the board. He's always called me to get involved, you know, whenever I'm home. And in fact, Tony used to play with the Jukes in the 70s. So he has a connection to Steven. And I got a call literally a couple days before the taping of the event, which it was a virtual streaming this year. And we did it at the Paramount Theater. And I called Richie and Jack and Andy. And unfortunately, Rich and Andy weren't available. So I got some of my local friends, Jack Daly was able to do it. And I got a couple of local friends to come and join me. My friend, Dave Anthony and Arna Wendt and Mike Flynn and Mike McKernan. And, you know, we just went and did, I think we taped three songs from the record, and then they ended up, all the bands were basically using two songs. So we ended up doing Shattered and the B-side, Hand-Me-Down.
Oh, cool. We're going to talk about the B-side now, but one last question about the Light of Day benefit. I thought Steven had performed as part of that as well. And if so, was that like a double duty thing for you? Were you performing with him as well or playing with him?
Very interesting. You know, when we were in Liverpool in 2017, we did the show at the Cavern, which was amazing, you know, and it's, you know, we were rehearsing on the tour bus, like in the UK, literally. And, you know, we'd have like these 6-hour bus rides, and we would be in the back with Steven doing these Beatle arrangements. And it was pretty cool, you know, and it made the bus ride go really quickly. So we taped that then. And anyway, so they're releasing that now. So they thought it'd be a great idea for, you know, to somehow have that as part of the Light of Day. So we didn't actually do a performance. Louis Arzonico, who is Steven's, he's head of all of Steven's graphics, and he puts all the albums together at Wicked Cool, super talented. Louis put together like a special edit of our performance from the Cavern. So there really wasn't double duty. It was sort of a gift, you know, like, and it was able, they were able to air it each day. And, you know, it's a charity. So, you know, if everyone could sell some records, and it's a win-win, you know?
Right. Well, do you have any other streaming shows lined up or any live gigs on your calendar for the future?
I'll tell you what, Manfred, I'm itching to get out and perform, you know, certainly music for my record. We're making some videos now. We're going to do some virtual streams right now. And since September, every weekend we play outdoors, and it's COVID. So I'm really careful. You know, I mentioned I take care of my dad. I won't play inside. I'm until this is really under control.
Yeah.
We played this past Sunday. It was 34 degrees outside. And there's no heaters. I mean, and a few hundred people come to see us at this. We play on the green of a golf course, right? Literally 50 feet from a bar restaurant that this guy, Bill Epp, owns. It's called McCann's. It's in Wall Township. It's Spring Meadow Golf Club, right? So we set up. We get there around 12:30. We're set up to play by 1:30, and we play outside with half gloves on, like our fingertips are exposed.
Yeah.
Multi layers, and it is fucking medicine, man. It's medicine for us, and people are dying for live music, and they come. People come and they drink hot toddies, and, you know, They wear parkas. You know, it's the weirdest thing.
It's a field of dreams, Mark.
It's the field of dreams, brother. And it is, it's crazy, man. There's pictures of us and we're surrounded by snow. and if you told me a year ago that I would be doing this in 30 degree weather, but the reward is so much greater than the pain of, you know, your fingers being numb. So that's what we're doing now as far as live performance. And hopefully, you know, I'm hoping that maybe as soon as this is under control, we get out to, I don't know if it'll ever be business as usual again, but we got to get back out, man.
We got to get back out. And right now we need to give the flip side to Shattered some love. It's the singles B-side, Hand Me Down. So that was recorded the same time as Shattered.
That's right, man. We went in. Interesting thing. I wrote that song. Another song that I wrote, a few of the songs are pretty recent, but that one I'd written probably in 2013. A lot of times I will, in my studio, like I'll hear a groove, you know, I'll use drum machines or I'll play drums, but a lot of times I'll just tap something out on my desk and put a microphone up, you know? So I was feeling like this raga, you know? And I basically recorded acoustic guitar and some vocals and just made a demo and just left it. And then I was searching through my older songs when I was getting ready to go in to make the record. And I found that and I was like, man, this is cool. Let me try it with the band. And we spent some time. Richie, actually, I had him lay down this really aggressive drum part that was kind of like a raga, like a rock and roll drum kit tone. And I brought it home and it was just too aggressive. It just got away. It's a more, it has an intimate quality to it, Hand Me Down.
Well, you know, and what, man, to me, it's got this very cool Graham Gouldman 60s kind of vibe to it. Like something he might've given the Hollies, like Look Through Any Window, or even reminiscent of Bus Stop in Places, or, you know, you got the bongos going in there. Makes me think of For Your Love even.
Oh, cool, man. Yeah. I mean, it's great that you point that out. I mean, that's the music that I grew up with before I knew that I was growing up with music. You know what I mean? It's like those songs were on the radio and, you know, somehow it filtered in there. And it's interesting how it comes out later in life. But yeah, man, that's a great compliment. And yeah, it's sort of like that's, it has like a little bit of that psychedelic sort of, you know, I guess the East Indian percussion kind of probably brings
too. So now this one, did you write this one? We talked about Christina and lyrics, and I was wondering here, were you the sole lyricist?
Yes. I wrote all the songs on the record except for Shattered. I co-wrote with Christina Aldendiefer, and Stephen made a great contribution to this song Fly Away. He wrote this great anthemic outro. And so Stephen is a co-writer on Fly Away. Mm-hmm. So I wrote the lyrics, the music and lyrics for Hand Me Down. And so when I was working on it, I realized it needed the Indian percussion thing. And I called my friend Dave Anthony, who is, I actually hired him for Darlene Love's gig. He was our percussionist. He plays every culture, their percussion instrument, you know, Latin. He plays on my new record. He plays on the song Manzanillo. Great Latin percussionist. Great East Indian percussionist. So he played tabla and djembe, and it made it that breathed the correct rhythmic life into the song. And when I played it for Steven, and then at the time I wrote this string arrangement, and I would write it, like I'll write it in Pro Tools, like with MIDI, you know, with samples.
Right.
And I sent the arrangement to my friend Jonathan Dinklage, who I hire for all of Steven's records. He does he plays all the strings. And he sent me back the strings, and the song was essentially done. And I played it for Steven, and he loved it. And just, you know, that was one of the songs that we kind of just did a couple little things to, and it was done, you know. And
another cool thing about that song is that "la la la la" as you're singing that, if you're not paying close attention to the lyrics, it could be like any la 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 kind of thing, like a placeholder almost. But as I was listening more closely to the lyrics, I was thinking, no, I mean, it's not just a placeholder. We're singing about lies and untruths, and, you know, that relates back to the kind of the story of that's going on in the song. And I just thought, oh, that's just extra clever. I love that.
Oh, man, that's a great, That's a brilliant distinction. And thanks for realizing that, Manfred. Yeah, it's lie. You know, it's not, there's no laws in that song. It's all, that's great, man. I'm glad, thanks for pointing that out.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for chatting with me on Our Coolest Conversations.
Fantastic, man. And be safe out there, man. And I hope to see you real soon, brother.
Oh, yeah. I look forward to giving you a good hard squeeze when I hug you, okay?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, man.
Well, it's B-side time now on Little Steven's Underground Garage. Here's Mark Ribbler with Hand Me Down. Hand Me Down from Mark Ribbler here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. That's the B-side to his single Shattered, available now from Wicked Cool Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Mark for speaking with me on today's Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. And be sure and join me next time around when my guest will be Jen Dangora. She's the front woman in Boston's The Shanghailos. We'll talk about the band and their debut EP called Kick It Like a Wicked Habit. That's your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Don't let it slide, baby, diamond ring.